Portland swing dancing competition. Our tune was a slightly slowed-down dance mix version of Casey and the Sunshine Band's Boogie Shoes. This isn't a coincidence, I thought, watching them. The boy was wearing blue jeans and a crew-neck shirt. She had on a white blouse with the tails hanging down over faded red clam diggers. That amazing hair was pulled back in the same impudently cute ponytail Christy had always worn when we danced competitively, along with her bobby socks and the vintage poodle skirt, of course. This cannot be a coincidence. They were doing a Lindy variation I knew as the Hells a Poppin'. It's supposed to be a fast dance, lightning fast, if you have the physical stamina and grace to bring it off, but they were dancing it slow because they were still learning their steps. I could see inside every move. I knew them all, although I hadn't actually danced any of them in 5 years or more. Come together, both hands clasped. He stoops a little, kicks with his left foot while she does the same, both of them twisting at the waist so that they appear to be going in opposite directions. Move apart, hands still clasped. Then she twirls, first to the left and then to the right. Ah, but they goofed up the return spin and she went sprawling on the grass. Jesus, Richie, you never get that right. Gah, you're hopeless. She was laughing, though. She flopped on her back and stared up at the sky.
"I'm sorry, Miss Scarlet,"
the boy cried in a screechy pickaninny voice that would have gone over like a lead balloon in the politically correct 21st century.
"I's just a clod-hoppin' country boy, but I intends to learn this here dance and it kills me."
"I'm the only one it's likely to kill," she said. "Stop the record again before I lose my..." Then they both saw me. It was a strange moment. There was a veil in Derry. I came to know that veil so well I could almost see it. The locals were on one side. People from away, like Fred Toomey, like me, were on the other. Sometimes the locals came out from behind it, as Mrs. Starr at the librarian had when expressing her irritation about the misplaced census records. But if you asked too many questions, and certainly if you startled them, they retreated behind it again. Yet I had startled these kids, and they didn't retreat behind the veil. Instead of closing up, their faces remained wide open, full of curiosity and interest. "Sorry, sorry," I said. "Didn't mean to surprise you. I heard the music, and then I saw you Lindy hopping." "Trying to Lindy hop is what you mean," the boy said. He helped the girl to her feet. He made a bow. "Richie Tozier, at your service. My friends all say, Richie, Richie, he live in a ditchy, but what do they know?" "Nice to meet you," I said. "George Amberson." And then it just popped out. "My friends all say, Georgie, Georgie, he wash his clothes in a Norgie, but they don't know anything either." The girl collapsed on one of the picnic table benches, giggling. The boy raised his hands in the air and bugled,
"Strange grown-up gets off a good one. Wacka, wacka, wacka! Delightful! Ed McMahon, what have we got for this wonderful fella?"
"Well, Johnny, today's prizes on Who Do You Trust are a complete set of Encyclopedia Britannica and an Electrolux vacuum cleaner to suck 'em up with."
"Beep, beep, Richie,"
the girl said. She was wiping the corners of her eyes. This caused an unfortunate reversion to the screeching pickaninny voice.
"I'm sorry, Miss Scarlet. Don't be whooping on me. I still got scabs from the last time."
"Who are you, miss?" I asked. "Bevy Bevy. I live on the levee," she said, and started giggling again. "Sorry, Richie's a fool, but I have no excuse." "Beverly Marsh. You're not from around here, are you?" A thing everybody seemed to know immediately. "Nope. And you two don't seem like you are either. You're the first two Derryites I've met who don't seem grumpy."
"Yowza, it's a grumpy-ass town," Richie said, and took the tone arm off the record. It had been bumping on the final groove over and over.
"I understand folks are particularly worried about the children," I said. "Notice I'm keeping my distance. You guys on grass, me on sidewalk."
"They weren't all that worried when the murders were going on," Richie grumbled. You know about the murders? I nodded. I'm staying at the townhouse. Someone who works there told me.
Yeah, now that they're over, people are all concerned about the kids.
He sat down next to Bevy, who lived on the levee.
But when they were going on, you didn't hear Jack spit.
Richie, she said, beep, beep. This time the boy tried on a really atrocious Humphrey Bogart imitation.
Well, it's true, sweetheart, and you know it's true.
All that's over, Bevy told me. She was as earnest as a Chamber of Commerce booster. They just don't know it yet.
They, meaning the townspeople, or just grown-ups in general?
She shrugged as if to say, what's the difference?
But you do know?
As a matter of fact, we do, Richie said. He looked at me challengingly, but behind his mended glasses, that glint of maniacal humor was still in his eyes. I had an idea it never completely left them. I stepped onto the grass. Neither child fled, screaming. In fact, Beverly shoved over on the bench, elbowing Richie so he would do the same, and made room for me. They were either very brave or very stupid, and they didn't look stupid. Then the girl said something that flabbergasted me.
Do I know you? Do we know you?
Before I could answer, Richie spoke up.
No, it's not that. It's... I don't know.
Do you want something, Mr. Amberson? Is that it?
Actually, I do. Some information.
But how did you know that?
And how do you know I'm not dangerous?
They looked at each other and something passed between them. It was impossible to know just what, yet I felt sure of two things. They had sensed an otherness about me that went way beyond just being a stranger in town. But unlike the yellow card man, they weren't afraid of it. Quite the opposite. They were fascinated by it. I thought those two attractive, fearless kids could have told some stories if they wanted to. I've always remained curious about what those stories might have been.
You're just not, Richie said, and when he looked to the girl, she nodded agreement.
And you're sure that the bad times are over?
Mostly, Beverly said. Things will get better. In Derry, I think the bad times are over, Mr. Amberson. It's a hard place in a lot of ways.
Suppose I told you, just hypothetically, that there was one more bad thing on the horizon, something like what happened to a little boy named Dorsey Corcoran. They winced as if I'd pinched a place where the nerves lay close to the surface. Beverly turned to Richie and whispered in his ear. I'm not positive about what she said. It was quick and low. But it might have been,
that wasn't the clown.
Then she looked back at me.
What bad thing? Like when Dorsey's father?
Never mind. You don't have to know.
It was time to jump. These were the ones. I didn't know how I knew it, but I did.
Do you know some kids named Dunning?
I ticked them off on my fingers. Troy, Arthur, Harry, and Ellen.
Only Arthur's also called Tugga, Beverly said, matter-of-factly.
Sure, we know him. He goes to our school.
We're practicing the Lindy for the school talent show. It's just before Thanksgiving.
This Scarlet, she believe in getting an early start on the practicing,
Richie said. Beverly Marsh took no notice.
Tug has signed up for the show, too. He's going to lip-sync to Splish Splash.
She rolled her eyes. She was good at that.
Where does he live, do you know?
They knew, all right, but neither of them said. And if I didn't give them a little more, they wouldn't. I could see that in their faces.
Suppose I told you there's a good chance Tugga's never going to be in the talent show unless somebody watches out for him. His brothers and sister, too. Would you believe a thing like that?
The kids looked at each other again, conversing with their eyes. It went on a long time, 10 seconds, maybe. It was the sort of long gaze that lovers indulge in, but these teenagers couldn't be lovers. Friends, though, for sure. Close friends who'd been through something together.
Tugga and his family live on Cosset Street, Richie said finally.
That's what it sounded like, anyway.
Cosset? That's how people around here say it, Beverly told me. K-O-S-S-U-T-H. Cosset.
Got it. Now the only question was how much these kids were going to blab about our weird conversation on the edge of the barrens. Beverly was looking at me with earnest, troubled eyes. "But Mr. Amberson, I've met Tugger's dad. He works at the Center Street Market. He's a nice man, always smiling. The nice man doesn't live at home anymore," Richie interrupted. "His wife kicked him out." She turned to him, eyes wide. "Tug told you that?" "Nope, Ben Hanscom. Tug told him." "He's still a nice man," Beverly said in a small voice. "Always joking around and stuff, but never touchy-grabby." "Clowns joke around a lot, too," I said. They both jumped as if I'd pinched that vulnerable bundle of nerves again. "That doesn't make them nice." "We know," Beverly whispered. She was looking at her hands. Then she raised her eyes to me. "Do you know about the turtle?" She said turtle in a way that made it sound like a proper noun. I thought of saying I know about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and didn't. It was decades too early for Leonardo, Donatello, Raphael, and Michelangelo. So I just shook my head. She looked doubtfully at Richie. He looked at me, then back at her. "But he's good. I'm pretty sure he's good." She touched my wrist. Her fingers were cold. "Mr. Dunning's a nice man. And just because he doesn't live at home anymore doesn't mean he isn't." That hit home. My wife had left me, but not because I wasn't nice. "I know that." I stood up. "I'm going to be around Derry for a little while, and it would be good not to attract too much attention. Can you two keep quiet about this? I know it's a lot to ask," but they looked at each other and burst into laughter. When she could speak, Beverly said, "We can keep a secret." I nodded. "I'm sure you can. Kept a few this summer, I bet." They didn't reply to this. I cocked a thumb at the barrens. "Ever play down there?" "Once," Richie said. "Not anymore." He stood up and brushed off the seat of his blue jeans. "It's been nice talking to you, Mr. Amberson. Don't take any wooden Indians." He hesitated. "And be careful in Derry. It's better now, but I don't think it's ever going to be, you know, completely right." "Thanks. Thank you both. Maybe someday the Dunning family will have something to thank you for, too, but if things go the way I hope they will, they'll never know a thing," Beverly finished for me. "Exactly." Then, remembering something Fred Toomey had said, "Right with Evershop. You two take care of yourselves." "We will," Beverly said, then began to giggle again. "Keep washing those clothes in your Nodgy, Georgie." I skimmed a salute off the brim of my new summer straw and started to walk away. Then I had an idea and turned back to them. "Does that phonograph play at 33 1/3? "Like for LPs?" Richie asked. "Nah, our hi-fi at home does, but Bevy's is just a baby one that runs on batteries." "Watch what you call my record player, Toja," Beverly said. "I saved up for it." Then to me, "It just plays 78s and 45s. Only I lost the plastic thingy for the hole in the 45, so now it only plays 78s. 45 RPM should do," I said. "Start the record again, but play it at that speed." Slowing down the tempo while getting the hang of swing dance steps was something Christy and I had learned in our classes. "Crazy, Daddy," Richie said. He switched the speed control lever beside the turntable and started the record again. This time it sounded like everyone in Glenn Miller's band had swallowed Quaaludes. "Okay." I held out my hands to Beverly. "You watch, Richie." She took my hands with complete trust, looking up at me with wide blue, amused eyes. I wondered where she was and who she was in 2011. If she was even alive. Supposing she was, would she remember that a strange man who asked strange questions had once danced with her to a draggy version of In the Mood on a sunny September afternoon? I said,
You guys were doing it slow before, and this will slow you down even more, but you can still keep the beat. Plenty of time for each step. Time. Plenty of time. Start the record again, but slow it down. I pulled her toward me by our clasped hands, let her go back. We both bent like people underwater and kicked to the left while the Glenn Miller Orchestra played ba-da-da, ba-da-da-da-dee-dum at that same slow speed, like a wind-up toy that's almost unwound. She twirled to the left under my upraised hands. Stop, I said, and she froze with her back to me and our hands still linked. Now, squeeze my right hand to remind me what comes next. She squeezed, then rotated smoothly back and all the way around to the right. Cool, she said. Now I'm supposed to go under, then you bring me back, and I flip over. That's why we're doing it on the grass, so if I mess it up, I don't break my neck. I'll leave that part up to you, I said. I'm too ancient to be flipping anything but hamburgers. Richie once more raised his hands to the sides of his face. Wacka, wacka, wacka! Strange grown-up gets off another! Beep, beep, Richie, I said. That made him laugh. Now you try it, and work out hand signals for any other moves that go beyond the jitterbug two-step they do in the local soda shop. That way, even if you don't win the talent show contest, you'll look good. Richie took Beverly's hands and tried it. In and out, side to side, around to the left, around to the right. Perfect! She slipped feet first between Richie's spread legs, supple as a fish, and then he brought her back. She finished with a showy flip that brought her to her feet again. Richie took her hands and they repeated the whole thing. It was even better the second time. We lose the beat on the under and out, Richie complained. You won't when the record's playing at normal speed, trust me. I like it, Beverly said. It's like having the whole thing under glass. She did a little spin on the toes of her sneakers. I feel like Loretta Young at the start of a show when she comes in wearing a swirly dress.
They call me Arthur Murray. I'm from Missouri,
Richie said. He also looked pleased. I'm going to speed the record up, I said. Remember your signals and keep time. It's all about time. Glenn Miller played that old sweet song and the kids danced. On the grass, their shadows danced beside them. Out, in, dip, kick, spin left, spin right, go under, pop out, and flip. They weren't perfect this time, and they'd screw up the steps many times before they nailed them, if they ever did. But they weren't bad. Oh, to hell with that. They were beautiful. For the first time since I'd topped that rise on Route 7 and saw Derry hulking on the west bank of the Kandeskeg, I was happy. That was a good feeling to go on. So I walked away from them, giving myself the old advice as I went. Don't look back. Never look back. How often do people tell themselves that after an experience that is exceptionally good or exceptionally bad? Often, I suppose. And the advice usually goes unheeded. Humans were built to look back. That's why we have that swivel joint in our necks. I went half a block then, turned around, thinking they'd be staring at me. But they weren't. They were still dancing. And that was good. There was a city service station a couple of blocks down on Kansas Street, and I went into the office to ask directions to Kossuth Street, pronounced Kossuth. I could hear the whir of an air compressor and the tinny jangle of pop music from the garage bay, but the office was empty. That was fine with me because I saw something useful next to the cash register, a wire stand filled with maps. The top pocket held a single city map that looked dirty and forgotten. On the front was a photo of an exceptionally ugly Paul Bunyan statue cast in plastic. Paul had his axe over his shoulder and was grinning up into the summer sun. Only Derry, I thought, would take a plastic statue of a mythical logger as its icon. There was a newspaper dispenser just beyond the gas pumps. I took a copy of the Daily News as a prop and flipped a nickel on top of the pile of papers to join the other coins scattered there. I don't know if they're more honest in 1958, but they're a hell of a lot more trusting. According to the map, Cossett Street was on the Kansas Street side of town and turned out to be just a pleasant 15-minute stroll from the gas station. I walked under elm trees that had yet to be touched by the blight that would take almost all of them by the 70s, trees that were still as green as they'd been in July. Kids tore past me on bikes or played jacks in driveways. Little clusters of adults gathered at corner bus stops, marked by white stripes on telephone poles. Derry went about its business, and I went about mine. Just a fellow in a nondescript sport coat with his summer straw pushed back a little on his head, a fellow with a folded newspaper in one hand. He might be looking for a yard or garage sale. He might be checking for plummy real estate. Certainly he looked like he belonged here. So I hoped. Cossett was a hedge-lined street of old-fashioned New England saltbox houses. Sprinklers twirled on lawns. Two boys ran past me, tossing a football back and forth. A woman with her hair bound up in a kerchief and the inevitable cigarette dangling from her lower lip was washing the family car and occasionally spraying the family dog, who backed away, barking. Cossett Street looked like an exterior scene from some old fuzzy sitcom. Two little girls were twirling a skip rope while a third danced nimbly in and out, stutter-stepping effortlessly as she chanted, "Charlie Champlin went to France just to watch the ladies dance. Salute to the cap'n, salute to the queen. My old man drives a submarine." The skip rope slap, slap, slapped on the pavement. I felt eyes on me. The woman in the kerchief had paused in her labors, the hose in one hand, a big soapy sponge in the other. She was watching me approach the skipping girls. I gave them a wide berth and saw her go back to work. "You took a hell of a chance talking to those kids on Kansas Street," I thought. Only I didn't believe it. Walking a little too close to the skip rope girls, that would have been taking a hell of a chance. But Richie and Bev had been the right ones. I'd known it almost as soon as I laid eyes on them. And they had known it, too. We had seen eye to eye. "Do we know you?" the girl had asked. Bevy Bevy, who lived on the levee. Cossett dead-ended at a big building called the Westside Recreation Hall. It was deserted with a for sale by city sign on the crabgrassy lawn. Surely an object of interest for any self-respecting real estate hunter. Two houses down from it on the right, a little girl with carrot-colored hair and a face full of freckles was riding a bicycle with training wheels up and down an asphalt driveway. She sang variations of the same phrase over and over as she rode. "Bing bang, I saw the whole gang. Ding dang, I saw the whole gang. Ring rang, I saw the whole gang." I walked toward the wreck as though there was nothing in the world I wanted to see more. But from the corner of my eye, I continued to track little Carrot Top. She was swaying from side to side on the bicycle seat, trying to find out how much she could get away with before toppling over. Based on her scabby shins, this probably wasn't the first time she'd played the game. There was no name on the mailbox of her house, just the number, 379. I walked to the for sale sign and jotted information down on my newspaper. Then I turned around and headed back the way I'd come. As I passed 379 Cossett, on the far side of the street and pretending to be absorbed in my paper, a woman came out on the stoop. A boy was with her. He was munching something wrapped in a napkin, and in his free hand he was holding the Daisy air rifle with which, not so long from now, he would try to scare off his rampaging father. "Ellen," the woman called, "get off that thing before you fall off. Come in and get a cookie." Ellen Dunning dismounted, dropped her bike on its side in the driveway, and ran into the house, bugling, "Sing, sang, I saw the whole gang," at the top of her considerable lungs. Her hair, a shade of red far more unfortunate than Beverly Marsh's, bounced like bedsprings in revolt. The boy, who'd grow up to write a painfully composed essay that would bring me to tears, followed her. The boy, who was going to be the only surviving member of his family. Unless I changed it. And now that I had seen them, real people living their real lives, There seemed to be no other choice. Chapter 7. How should I tell you about my 7 weeks in Derry? How to explain the way I came to hate and fear it? It wasn't because it kept secrets, although it did, and it wasn't because terrible crimes, some of them still unsolved, had happened there, although they had. "All that's over," the girl named Beverly had said. The boy named Richie had agreed. And I came to believe that, too, although I also came to believe the shadow never completely left that city with its odd sunken downtown. It was a sense of impending failure that made me hate it. And that feeling of being in prison with elastic walls. If I wanted to leave, it would let me go, willingly. But if I stayed, it would squeeze me tighter. It would squeeze me until I couldn't breathe. And here's the bad part. Leaving wasn't an option. Because now I had seen Harry before the limp and before the trusting but slightly dazed smile. I had seen him before he became Hop-Toed Harry, hopping down the avenue. I had seen his sister, too. Now she was more than just a name in a painstakingly written essay, a faceless little girl who loved to pick flowers and put them in vases. Sometimes I lay awake thinking of how she planned to go trick-or-treating as Princess Summer, Fall, Winter, Spring. Unless I did something, that was never going to happen. There was a coffin waiting for her after a long and fruitless struggle for life. There was a coffin waiting for her mother, whose first name I still didn't know, and for Troy, and for Arthur, known as Tugga. If I let that happen, I didn't see how I could live with myself. So I stayed, but it wasn't easy. And every time I thought of putting myself through this again in Dallas, my mind threatened to freeze up. At least, I told myself, Dallas wouldn't be like Derry, because no place on earth could be like Derry. How should I tell you, then? In my life as a teacher, I used to hammer away at the idea of simplicity. In both fiction and nonfiction, there's only one question and one answer. What happened? The reader asks. This is what happened. The writer responds. This and this, and this too. Keep it simple. It's the only sure way home. So I'll try, although you must always keep in mind that in Derry, reality is a thin skim of ice over a deep lake of dark water. But still, what happened? This happened, and this too. On Friday, my second full day in Derry, I went down to the Center Street Market. I waited until 5 p.m. because I thought that was when the place would be busiest. Friday's payday, after all, and for a lot of people, by which I mean wives, one of the rules of life in 1958 is men don't buy groceries. That meant shopping day. Lots of shoppers would make it easier for me to blend in. To help in that regard, I went to W.T. Grant's and supplemented my wardrobe with some chinos and blue work shirts, remembering No Suspenders and his buddies outside the Sleepy Silver Dollar. I also bought a pair of Wolverine work boots. On my way to the market, I kicked them repeatedly against the curbing until the toes were scuffed. The place was every bit as busy as I'd hoped, with a line at all three cash registers and the aisles full of women pushing shopping carts. The few men I saw only had baskets, so that was what I took. I put a bag of apples in mine, dirt cheap, and a bag of oranges, almost as expensive as 2011 oranges. Beneath my feet, the oiled wooden floor creaked. What exactly did Mr. Dunning do in the Center Street Market? Bevy on the Levee hadn't said. He wasn't the manager. A glance into the glassed-in booth just behind the produce section showed a white-haired gentleman who could have claimed Ellen Dunning as a granddaughter, perhaps, but not as a daughter. And the sign on his desk said Mr. Curry. As I walked along the back of the store past the dairy case, I was amused by a sign reading, "Have you tried yogurt? If not, you will love it when you do." I began to hear laughter. female laughter of the immediately identifiable, "Oh, you rascal!" variety. I turned into the far aisle and saw a covey of women, dressed in much the same style as the ladies in the Kennebec Fruit, clustered around the meat counter. "The butchery," read the handmade wooden sign hanging down on decorative chrome chains, "homestyle cuts," and at the bottom, "Frank Dunning, head butcher." Sometimes life coughs up coincidences no writer of fiction would dare copy. It was Frank Dunning who was making the ladies laugh. The resemblance to the janitor who had taken my GED English course was close enough to be eerie. He was Harry, to the life, except this version's hair was almost completely black instead of almost all gray, and the sweet, slightly puzzled smile had been replaced by a raffish, razzle-dazzle grin. It was no wonder the ladies were all aflutter. Even Bevy on the levee thought he was the cat's meow, and why not? She might only be 12 or 13, but she was female, and Frank Dunning was a charmer. He knew it, too. There had to be reasons for the flowers of dairy womanhood to spend their husband's paychecks at the downtown market instead of at the slightly cheaper A&P, and one of them was right here. Mr. Dunning was handsome. Mr. Dunning wore spandy clean, clean whites. Slightly blood-stained at the cuffs, but he was a butcher, after all. Mr. Dunning wore a stylish white hat that looked like a cross between a chef's toque and an artist's beret. It hung down to just above one eyebrow. A fashion statement, by God. All in all, Mr. Frank Dunning, with his rosy, clean-shaven cheeks and his immaculately barbered black hair, was God's gift to the little woman. As I strolled toward him, he tied off a package of meat with a length of string drawn from a roll on a spindle beside his scale and wrote the price on it with a flourish of his black marker. He handed it to a lady of about 50 summers who was wearing a house dress with big pink roses blooming on it, seamed nylons, and a schoolgirl blush. "There you are, Mrs. Levesque. 1 pound of German bologna, sliced thin." He leaned confidentially over the counter, close enough so that Mrs. Levesque and the other ladies would be able to whiff on the entrancing aroma of his cologne. Was it Aqua Velva? Fred Toomey's brand? I thought not. I thought a fascinator like Frank Dunning would go for something a little more expensive. "Do you know the problem with German bologna?" "No," the other ladies twittered in anticipation. Dunning's eyes flicked briefly to me, and saw nothing to interest him. When he looked back at Mrs. Levesque, they once more picked up their patented twinkle. "An hour after you eat some, you're hungry for power." I'm not sure all the ladies got it, but they all shrieked with appreciation. Dunning sent Mrs. Levesque happily on her way, and as I passed out of hearing, he was turning his attention to a Mrs. Bowie, who would, I was sure, be equally happy to receive it. "He's a nice man. Always joking around and stuff." But the nice man had cold eyes. When interacting with his fascinated lady harem, they had been blue. But when he turned his attention to me, however briefly, I could have sworn that they turned gray, the color of water beneath a sky from which snow will soon fall. The market closed at 6 p.m., and when I left with my few items, it was only 20 past 5. There was a Unita lunch on Wycham Street just around the corner. I ordered a hamburger, a fountain Coke, and a piece of chocolate pie. The pie was excellent. Real chocolate, real cream. It filled my mouth the way Frank Ancietti's root beer had. I dawdled as long as I could, then strolled down to the canal where there were some benches. There was also a sight line, narrow, but adequate, to the Center Street Market. I was full, but ate one of my oranges anyway, casting bits of peel over the cement embankment and watching the water carry them away. Promptly at 6, the lights in the market's big front windows went out. By 4:15, the last of the ladies had exited, toting their carryalls either up Mile Hill or clustering at one of those phone poles with the painted white stripe. A bus marked Roundabout One Fair came along and scooped them up. At 6:45, the market employees began leaving. The last two to exit were Mr. Curry, the manager, and Dunning. They shook hands and parted, Curry going up the alley between the market and the shoe store next to it, probably to get his car, and Dunning to the bus stop. By then there were only two other people there, and I didn't want to join them. Thanks to the one-way traffic pattern in the low town, I didn't have to. I walked to another white-painted pole, this one handy to the Strand, where the current double feature was Machine Gun Kelly and Reform School Girl, the marquee promised blazing action, and waited with some working Joes who were talking about possible World Series matchups. I could have told them plenty about that, but kept my mouth shut. A city bus came along and stopped across from the Center Street Market. Dunning got on. It came the rest of the way down the hill and pulled up at the movie theater stop. I let the working Joes go ahead of me so I could watch how much money they put in the pole-mounted coin receptacle next to the driver's seat. I felt like an alien in a science fiction movie, one who's trying to masquerade as an earthling. It was stupid. I wanted to ride the city bus, not blow up the White House with a death ray, but that didn't change the feeling. One of the guys who got on ahead of me flashed a canary-colored bus pass that made me think fleetingly of the yellow card man. The others put 15 cents into the coin receptacle, which clicked and dinged. I did the same, although it took me a bit longer because my dime was stuck to my sweaty palm. I thought I could feel every eye on me, but when I looked up, everyone was either reading the newspaper or staring vacantly out the windows. The interior of the bus was a fog of blue-gray smoke. Frank Dunning was halfway down on the right, now wearing tailored gray slacks, a white shirt, and a dark blue tie. Natty. He was busy lighting a cigarette and didn't look at me as I passed him and took a seat near the back. The bus groaned its way around the circuit of low-town one-way streets, then mounted up Mile Hill on Witcham. Once we were in the West Side residential area, riders began to get off. They were all men. Presumably the women were back at home putting away their groceries or getting supper on the table. As the bus emptied and Frank Dunning went on sitting where he was, smoking his cigarette, I wondered if we were going to end up being the last two riders. I needn't have worried. When the bus angled toward the stop at the corner of Witcham Street and Charity Avenue, Derry also had Faith and Hope Avenues, I later learned. Dunning dropped his cigarette on the floor, crushed it with his shoe, and rose from his seat. He walked easily up the aisle, not using the grab handles, but swaying with the movements of the slowing bus. Some men don't lose the physical graces of their adolescence until relatively late in life. Dunning appeared to be one of them. He would have made an excellent swing dancer. He clapped the bus driver on the shoulder and started telling him a joke. It was short, and most of it was lost in the chuff of the air brakes, but I caught the phrase, "three jigs stuck in an elevator," and decided it wasn't one he'd have told to his house dress harem. The driver exploded with laughter, then yanked the long chrome lever that opened the front doors. "See you Monday, Frank," he said. "If the creek don't rise," Dunning responded, then ran down the two steps and jumped across the grass verge to the sidewalk. I could see muscles ripple under his shirt. What chance would a woman and four children have against him? Not much, was my first thought on the subject, but that was wrong. The correct answer was none. As the bus drew away, I saw Dunning mount the steps of the first building down from the corner on Charity Avenue. There were 8 or 9 men and women sitting in rockers on the wide front porch. Several of them greeted the butcher, who started shaking hands like a visiting politician. The house was a 3-story New England Victorian with a sign hanging from the porch eave. I just had time to read it. Edna Price, rooms by the week or the month. Efficiency kitchens available. No pets. Below this, hanging from the big sign on hooks, was a smaller orange sign reading, "No Vacancy." 2 stops further down the line, I exited the bus. I thanked the driver, who uttered a surly grunt in return. This, I was discovering, was what passed for courteous discourse in Derry, Maine. Unless, of course, you happen to know a few jokes about jigs stuck in an elevator. Or maybe the Polish Navy. I walked slowly back toward town, jogging 2 blocks out of my way to keep clear of Edna Price's establishment, where those in residence gathered on the porch after supper, just like folks in one of those Ray Bradbury stories about bucolic Greentown, Illinois. And did not Frank Dunning resemble one of those good folks? He did. He did. But there had been hidden horrors in Bradbury's Greentown, too. "The nice man doesn't live at home anymore," Richie from the Ditchy had said. And he'd had the straight dope on that one. The nice man lived in a rooming house where everybody seemed to think he was the cat's ass. By my estimation, Price's rooms was no more than 5 blocks west of 379 Cosset Street, and maybe closer. Did Frank Dunning sit in his rented room after the other tenants had gone to bed, facing east, like one of the faithful turning toward Qibla? If so, did he do it with his, "Hey, great to see you," smile on his face? I thought, no. And were his eyes blue, or did they turn that cold and thoughtful gray? How did he explain leaving his hearth and home to the folks taking the evening air on Edna Price's porch? Did he have a story? One where his wife was either a little bit cracked or an outright villain? I thought, yes. And did people believe it? The answer to that one was easy. It doesn't matter if you're talking 1958, 1985, or 2011. In America, where surface has always passed for substance, people always believe guys like Frank Dunning. On the following Tuesday, I rented an apartment advertised in the Derry News as semi-furnished in a good neighborhood, and on Wednesday, the 17th of September, Mr. George Amberson moved in. Goodbye, Derry Townhouse. Hello, Harris Avenue. I had been living in 1958 for over a week and was beginning to feel comfortable there, if not exactly a native. The semi-furnishings consisted of a bed, which came with a slightly stained mattress, but no linen, a sofa, a kitchen table with one leg that needed to be shimmed so it didn't teeter, and a single chair with a yellow plastic seat that made a weird smook sound as it reluctantly released its grip on the seat of one's pants. There was a stove and a clattery fridge. In the kitchen pantry, I discovered the apartment's air conditioning unit, a GE fan, with a frayed plug that looked absolutely lethal. I felt that the apartment, which was directly beneath the flight path of planes landing at Derry Airport, was a bit overpriced at $65 a month, but agreed to it because Mrs. Joplin, the landlady, was willing to overlook Mr. Amberson's lack of references. It helped that he could offer 3 months' rent in cash. She nevertheless insisted on copying the information from my driver's license. If she found it strange that a real estate freelancer from Wisconsin was carrying a Maine license, she didn't say so. I was glad Al had given me lots of cash. Cash is so soothing to strangers. It goes a lot farther in 58, too. For only $300... I was able to turn my semi-furnished apartment into one that was fully furnished. 90 of the 300 went for a second-hand RCA table model television. That night, I watched the Steve Allen Show in beautiful black and white, then turned it off and sat at the kitchen table, listening to a plane settle earthward in a roar of propellers. From my back pocket, I took a Blue Horse notebook I'd bought in the Lowtown drugstore, the one where shoplifting was not a kick, groove, or gasser. I turned to the first page and clicked out the tip of my equally new Parker ballpoint. I sat that way for maybe 15 minutes, long enough for another plane to clatter earthward, seemingly so close that I almost expected to feel a thump as the wheels scraped the roof. The page remained blank. So did my mind. Every time I tried to throw it into gear, the only coherent thought I could manage was the past doesn't want to be changed. Not helpful. At last I got up, took the fan from its shelf in the pantry, and set it on the counter. I wasn't sure it would work, but it did. And the hum of the motor was strangely soothing. Also, it masked the fridge's annoying rumble. When I sat down again, my mind was clearer. And this time a few words came. Options. Number one, tell police. Number two, anonymous call to Butcher. Say, I'm watching you, MF. If you do something, I'll tell. Number three, frame Butcher for something. Number four, incapacitate Butcher somehow. I stopped there. The fridge clicked off. There were no descending planes and no traffic on Harris Avenue. For the time being, it was just me and my fan and my incomplete list. At last, I wrote the final item. Number five, kill Butcher. Then I crumpled it, opened the box of kitchen matches that sat beside the stove to light the burners in the oven, and scratched one. The fan promptly whiffed it out, and I thought again how hard it was to change some things. I turned the fan off, lit another match, and touched it to the ball of notepaper. When it was blazing, I dropped it into the sink, waited for it to go out, then washed the ashes down the drain. After that, Mr. George Amberson went to bed. But he did not sleep for a long time. When the last plane of the night skimmed over the rooftop at 12:30, I was still awake and thinking of my list. Telling the police was out. It might work with Oswald, who would declare his undying love for Fidel Castro in both Dallas and New Orleans, but Dunning was a different matter. He was a well-liked and well-respected member of the community. Who was I? The new guy in a town that didn't like outsiders? That afternoon, after coming out of the drugstore, I'd once again seen No Suspenders and his crew outside the Sleepy Silver Dollar. I was wearing my workingman clothes, but they had given me that same flat-eyed, "Who the fuck are you?" look. Even if I'd been living in Derry for 8 years instead of 8 days, just what would I say to the police anyway? That I'd had a vision of Frank Dunning killing his family on Halloween night? That would certainly go over well. I liked the idea of placing an anonymous call to the butcher himself a little better. But it was a scary option. Once I called Frank Dunning, either at work or at Edna Price's, where he would no doubt be summoned to the communal phone in the parlor, I would have changed events. Such a call might stop him from killing his family, but I thought it just as likely it would have the opposite effect. Tipping him over the precarious edge of sanity, he must be walking behind the affable George Clooney smile. Instead of preventing the murders, I might only succeed in making them happen sooner. As it was, I knew where and when. If I warned him, all bets were off. Frame him for something? It might work in a spy novel, but I wasn't a CIA agent. I was a goddamn English teacher. Incapacitate Butcher was next on the list. Okay, but how? Smack him with the sunliner? Maybe as he walked from Charity Avenue to Cossett Street with a hammer in his hand and murder on his mind? Unless I had amazing luck, I'd be caught and jailed. There was this, too. Incapacitated people usually get better. He might try again once he did. As I lay there in the dark, I found that scenario all too plausible, because the past didn't like to be changed. It was obdurate. The only sure way was to follow him, wait until he was alone, and then kill him. Keep it simple, stupid. But there were problems with this, too. The biggest was that I didn't know if I could go through with it. I thought I could in hot blood to protect myself or another, but in cold blood, even if I knew that my potential victim was going to kill his own wife and children if he weren't stopped? And what if I did it and then got caught before I could escape to the future where I was Jake Epping instead of George Amberson? I'd be tried, found guilty, sent to Shawshank State Prison. And that was where I'd be on the day John F. Kennedy was killed in Dallas. Even that wasn't the absolute bottom of the matter. I got up, paced through the kitchen to my phone booth of a bathroom, went to the toilet, then sat on the seat with my forehead propped on the heels of my palms. I had assumed Harry's essay was the truth. Al had too. It probably was, because Harry was 2 or 3 degrees on the dim side of normal, and people like that are less liable to try passing off fantasies like the murder of an entire family as reality. Still, 95% probability isn't 100, Al had said, and that was Oswald himself he'd been talking about. Just about the only person the killer could have been once you set aside all the conspiracy babble, and yet Al still had those last lingering doubts. It would have been easy to check out Harry's story in the computer-friendly world of 2011, but I never had. And even if it was completely true, there might be crucial details he'd gotten wrong, or not mentioned at all. Things that could trip me up. What if instead of riding to the rescue like Sir Galahad, I only managed to get killed along with them? That would change the future in all sorts of interesting ways. But I wouldn't be around to discover what they were. A new idea popped into my head, one that was crazily attractive. I could station myself across from 379 Cosset on Halloween night and just watch. To make sure it really happened, yes, but also to note all the details the only living witness, a traumatized child, might have missed. Then I could drive back to Lisbon Falls, go up through the rabbit hole, and immediately return to September 9th at 11:58 in the morning. I'd buy the Sunliner again and go to Derry again, this time loaded with information. It was true, I'd already spent a fair amount of Al's currency, but there was enough left to get by on. The idea ran well out of the gate, but stumbled before it even got to the first turn. The whole purpose of this trip had been to find out what effect saving the janitor's family would have on the future. And if I let Frank Dunning go through with the murders, I wouldn't know. And I was already faced with having to do this again because there would be one of those resets when, if, I went back through the rabbit hole to stop Oswald. Once was bad. Twice would be worse. 3 times was unthinkable. And one other thing, Harry Dunning's family had already died once. Was I going to condemn them to die a second time? Even if each time was a reset and they didn't know? And who was to say that on some deep level they didn't? The pain, the blood, little Carrot Top lying on the floor under the rocker, Harry trying to scare the lunatic off with a Daisy air gun. "Leave me alone, Daddy, or I'll shoot you." I shuffled back through the kitchen, pausing to look at the chair with the yellow plastic seat. "I hate you, chair," I told it, then went to bed again. That time I fell asleep almost immediately. When I woke up the next morning, a 9 o'clock sun was shining in my as-yet curtainless bedroom window. Birds were twittering, self-importantly, and I thought I knew what I had to do. Keep it simple, stupid. At noon, I put on my tie, set my straw hat at the correct rakish angle, and took myself down to Macon's Sporting Goods, where the fall gun sale was still going on. I told the clerk I was interested in buying a handgun because I was in the real estate business and occasionally I had to carry quite large amounts of cash. He showed me several, including a Colt 38 police special revolver. The price was $9.99. That seemed absurdly low until I remembered that, according to Al's notes, the Italian mail-order rifle Oswald had used to change history had cost less than 20. "This is a fine piece of protection," the clerk said, rolling out the barrel and giving it a spin. Click, 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 click. "Dead accurate up to 15 yards, guaranteed. And anyone stupid enough to try mugging you out of your cash is going to be a lot closer than that. Sold." I braced for an examination of my scant paperwork, but had once again forgotten to take into account the relaxed and unterrified atmosphere of the America where I was now living. The way the deal worked was this. I paid my money and walked out with the gun. There was no paperwork and no waiting period. I didn't even have to give my current address. Oswald had wrapped his gun in a blanket and hidden it in the garage of the house where his wife was staying with a woman named Ruth Payne. But when I walked out of Macon's with mine in my briefcase, I thought I knew how he must have felt, like a man with a powerful secret, a man who owned his own private tornado. A guy who should have been at work in one of the mills was standing in the doorway of the sleepy Silver Dollar, smoking a cigarette and reading the paper. Appearing to read the paper, at least. I couldn't swear he was watching me, but then again, I couldn't swear he wasn't. It was no suspenders. That evening, I once more took up a position close to the Strand, where the marquee read, "Opens tomorrow, Thunder Road, Mitchum, and the Vikings, Douglas." More blazing action in the offing for dairy filmgoers. Dunning once more crossed to the bus stop and climbed aboard. This time I didn't follow. There was no need. I knew where he was going. I walked back to my new apartment, looking around every now and then for no suspenders. There was no sign of him, and I told myself that seeing him across from the sporting goods store had just been a coincidence. Not a big one, either. The Sleepy was his joint of choice, after all. Because the dairy mills ran 6 days a week, the workers had rotating off days. Thursday could have been one of this guy's. Next week he might be hanging at the Sleepy on Friday, or Tuesday. The following evening I was once more at the Strand, pretending to study the poster for Thunder Road, Robert Mitchum roars down the hottest highway on earth, mostly because I'd nowhere else to go. Halloween was still 6 weeks away, and I seemed to have entered the time-killing phase of our program. But this time, instead of crossing to the bus stop, Frank Dunning walked down to the three-way intersection of Center, Kansas, and Wycheham, and stood there, as if undecided. He was once more looking reet in dark slacks, white shirt, blue tie, and a sport coat in a light gray windowpane check. His hat was cocked back on his head. For a moment I thought he was going to head for the movies and check out the hottest highway on earth, in which case I would stroll casually away toward Canal Street. But he turned left onto Wycheham. I could hear him whistling. He was a good whistler. There was no need to follow him. He wasn't going to commit any hammer murders on the 19th of September. But I was curious, and I had nothing better to do. He went into a bar and grill called the Lamplighter, not as upper crust as the one at the townhouse, but nowhere near as grotty as the ones on Canal. In every small city there are one or two borderland joints where blue-collar and white-collar workers meet as equals, and this looked like that kind of place. Usually the menu features some local delicacy that makes outsiders scratch their head in puzzlement. The Lamplighter's specialty seemed to be something called fried lobster pickins. I passed the wide front windows lounging rather than walking and saw Dunning greet his way across the room. He shook hands, he patted cheeks, he took one man's hat and scaled it to a guy standing at the Bullmore machine who caught it deftly and to general hilarity. A nice man. Always joking around. Laugh and the whole world laughs with you type of thing. I saw him sit down at a table close to the Bullmore and almost walked on. But I was thirsty. A beer would go down fine just about now, and the Lamplighter's bar was all the way across a crowded room from the large table where Dunning was sitting with the all-male group he had joined. He wouldn't see me, but I could keep an eye on him in the mirror. not that I was apt to see anything too startling. Besides, if I was going to be here for another 6 weeks, it was time to start belonging here. So I turned around and entered the sounds of cheerful voices, slightly inebriated laughter,